Thank you, Dr. John. And good evening, members of this powerful, mysterious disease. And good evening, confused thousands. I bring to you greetings from Detroit, Michigan, we've been called the arsenal of the world. We make automobiles there and aerospace equipment. But I want to bring you greetings from the 20,000 members of AA in Michigan. We've got a good-sized organization. We're meeting next week in Grand Rapids. I am very grateful for this invitation, which came about through Dr. John Mooney. And you know how anonymous this program is. They have me announced in another program elsewhere as Dr. Aloysius C., Psychiatrist of Detroit. How anonymous can you be? I will identify myself. I am a drinker of 35 years practice and experience. And I mean drinker. There's nothing sissy about my drinking. I'm a physician, MD, for 27 years and specializing in psychiatry for that length of time. I must tell you this. I've had 11 years of university training. My wife told me to tell you this. She said, you look so stupid that... they won't believe it. They won't believe anything you say, so tell them that you're 11 years old. I'm 54 years of age and in menopause. And I tell you that because if I have a little flush here, it's not from embarrassment. It's a real hot flash. I've been 7 years in this program, almost 7 years, but I must emphasize a day at a time. And I'm that kind of a practitioner of this program, a day at a time. And I mean a day at a time with the 12 steps a day at a time. For a while, I was sober on the first step for a day at a time, but I learned that there are 12 steps. And each year, I learn more about the program. Not so long ago, at a closed meeting, the words of take a fearless moral inventory. It dawned on me, I've been in a program almost 7 years, it's coming to me now, it should be fearless inventory. And I've been taking a sort of an inventory. And then when it came to the step not so long ago, maybe 5 or 6 months ago at a closed meeting, where the words came to mind, it was such a new impact. And I know I've got to practice these steps word for word. And here were the words of the inventory phase. To make yourself entirely ready. I've always been half ready. And there are a few telephone numbers that I had tucked away that I discarded that day. I'm a psychiatrist, and I want to differentiate that from a psychologist. There is a difference, as you know. There is a difference between psychiatry and psychology. I was introduced as a psychiatrist, and the program chairman said, now there's a difference, and I'll give you that difference now. A psychiatrist goes down deeper, stays down longer, and comes up dirtier. Now, John Mooney is a general practitioner, and I'm a psychiatrist. There's a difference between a general doctor and a psychiatrist. And that came to my attention when my daughter, who is now 20, was 2 years or in the second grade. And there, a teacher in school admonished the class, children, cover your coughs, the teacher said. Coughs spread colds. My daughter put her hand up and said, yes, I know that, teacher. My father is a physician. Well, the teacher, knowing I was a psychiatrist, asked my daughter, what is the difference between a physician and a psychiatrist? Knowing that I was a psychiatrist. My daughter said, after thinking but a moment, psychiatrists have mustaches. Now, I think you're foolish to your program committee, and I think the program committee is in poor judgment, to invite a psychiatrist to talk After all, you know what a psychiatrist does. He listens. He's a professional listener. Now, asking a listener to be a speaker here is really poor judgment. And then think about it further. I do not talk to my patients. I listen. And I don't listen to two of them. I'm never with two of them. I'm always with one of them. I'm certainly very careful to avoid talking to even man and wife together. That's very dangerous. You get your head knocked off. But I tell you that because I'm a bit nervous. Talking and dealing with one person at a time and listening, and then to confront a large number of people at these large meetings, I get a little bit shaky, believe me. And you people have seen everything in AA, and if you haven't yet seen a nervous psychiatrist, this is your opportunity. My feeling at this and other meetings, and certainly at this one, I want to tell you at the outset how much I enjoyed the atmosphere, the non-hotelish atmosphere, the serenity in the air itself, and the quiet. But I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this, accepting this invitation. But my feeling at any meeting is one of gratitude. Real gratitude. It's a heartfelt gratitude. I'm more grateful. I dare say an alcoholic dare say a lot of things, even if it's sober. I dare say I'm more grateful than all of you could be if you were to measure and put your gratitude together. I'm more grateful than all of you could be grateful put together, and I can prove it to you or make that attempt. In the past 16 years, I've cared for, directly or indirectly, in this hospital of which I was medical director, for some 9,000 alcoholics. 9,000, not 90 or 900, but 9,000. And I've seen, as a physician, I've seen the alcoholic in his physical state, psychological state, and social state. And I know what happens firsthand. I know what happens with this substance in the alcoholic physically. I've seen the laboratory findings and the x-ray findings and the EKG findings. As a matter of fact, I've seen 12 of the 16 who died in this course of time autopsied. I've seen their insides. I've put the liver in this hand and the brain in this hand, and I know what happened to the spleen, the liver, the pancreas, the kidney, and the lung. And I'm sure if I had their toenails examined or something, they still would have the alcohol in them, because I think this stuff goes all over the person. But I know the alcoholic physically, and I know the misery of the physical alcoholic, and I know what can happen to him, and what a destructive disease this is physically. But I also know what happened to the alcoholic psychologically as a psychiatrist. I know the impairment of the finer judgments, the finer social sensibilities, the reasoning. I know what happens to the thinking processes. I don't have to tell you that. You have witnessed this over and over again in your lives. You've seen people come to parties, and you've seen them properly attired with the proper vocabulary and thinking coherently and relevantly. And after a few drinks, they are unzipped and unbuttoned and peanuts over their vest and shirt and ketchup all over the trousers. I know you've seen that. I know that you've seen them dig into their pockets for telephone numbers and all the thoughts and thinking as a result of this product. They didn't get that way by the kind of care they had, by the kind of early childhood they had. They got that way from alcohol, a chemical, to which we are hypersensitive. We are so different from the 65 million people who are drinking happily and can take it. But the impaired judgment I have seen, and I know what happens with the... I have seen in large numbers what happens to the psychological self of the alcoholic. And having talked to the spouses of alcoholics and the children of alcoholics, I know what can happen to the alcoholic socially. Having talked to probation officers and lawyers and narcotics men and homicide squad men, detectives and credit men and all various people that continually contact the alcoholic in large scale, I know what happens to the alcoholic socially. In large numbers, I have seen this. And to come here tonight to be invited, and to come here tonight unescorted, I walked up there, up these steps myself, and stand here, believe me, and I'm in fairly good health, believe me. When I first came into this program, my liver was down, And each time I went to the doctor for a physical examination, they would check the liver. One of my friends said if you had continued to drink, your liver would have developed floor burns. Drag on the floor. I can assure you that last examination, which was not so long ago, the liver was in proper position under the rib line here, and I'm very happy about it. After having this experience, and to be able to stand here physically and be unsupported, it makes me grateful in itself. Psychologically, as you will note, I'm not entirely there, all there. But there's no man with a white coat chasing me. And I haven't taken any pill to stand up here or anything like that. So psychologically, I'm not in too bad a shape, as you'll see. And socially, I wasn't chased here, and I have nobody after me. And I'm in good standing with my wife. I think she's dropped the divorce proceedings that I thought she was organizing with this friend. I thought he was, it would take me for a ride. But I'm in good standing. So can you see, after having this experience of 9,000 people and having this first-hand information to know what happens to them physically, psychologically, and socially, and to be able to stand like this, why I should be even in doubt? I am grateful. I am grateful to be sober, to be here, and to talk, and to tell you that I'm in fairly good health. It's a wonderful feeling, believe me, my gratitude. I know that you're grateful, and I want you to keep your gratitude. But if you were to take your gratitude, your basket of gratitude, and dump it over here on the floor, and we'd measure all this gratitude, I'm sure that my big basket of gratitude would have in it more gratitude than all of the gratitude you had in your little basket. Now, I'm not telling you to discard this little basket of gratitude. I want you to hold on to it because it's a great thing, believe me. One of the faulty attitudes as you get in this program of sobriety is that of resentment. You know that. It's a number one enemy for the alcoholic in AA. Hang on to that gratitude, because I've seen people who were resentful, and these resentments led them to a lot of trouble. Resentments. And I know of no treatment for resentments. I know of no secanol, barbitol, nembutal, thorazine, spirine, librium, equinol. I know none of these. I don't know of any chemical that will get you out of this resentment's attitude. I don't know of any psychological treatment. I don't know of any psychoanalytic treatment that will get you rid of this resentment. I don't know of any treatment. What is the treatment? You know, the treatment for resentment is gratitude. If your mind were a container... Oh, boy. Water. If your mind were a container, and you had these resentments, they adhere like a sticky, resinous stuff to the sides of your mind. Now, I know of no therapy for that. As a physician and a psychiatrist, I know no chemical or even the fanciest brands of psychotherapy. No psychological scalpel to peel that resentment out of your mind. But if you pour gratitude into that mind, day after day, hour after hour, this will dissolve. The gratitude will dissolve this resinous, sticky stuff. And you'll be a normal, well-balanced being. Believe me, you'll be serene. And you've got to have this gratitude. So don't let me give you the impression to discard your gratitude. I'm just saying, keep on. Keep your little basket. You may think, when I mention that number 9,000, well, I know what you think. I know what alcoholics think. When I mention that my experience with 9,000 alcoholics, there's another alcoholic. Boy, he uses big numbers. Exaggerate. 9,000 alcoholics. But believe me, it wasn't, and there's no boast at all, because it took 5,000, in the vicinity of 5,800 alcoholics to come past me before I recognized I was one myself. So there was no boast in the use of that figure. Now you can picture an X-ray man who was working in a tuberculosis sanatorium, and he takes X-rays day after day, and he takes the X-ray, one X-ray, and he says, now here's an X-ray of a patient of ours. He has a cavity in the right lung here. He has infiltration and consolidation and so forth and so on. This is tuberculosis. And he puts it down, number one. See, number two, here's another X-ray. Here's a cavity in the left lung, infiltration, consolidation. And he goes on and on like that for a couple thousand x-rays, and then he comes across his x-rays of consolidation, infiltration, consolidation here, and so forth. This is tuberculosis. But he looks at the name here, and he says, can't be, it's my x-ray. It just can't be. So he files it away, and that's the way it was with me. To see all of these x-rays before me every day, 5,800 before I came to this diagnosis of my own condition of alcoholism. And that's the way it was. Powerful, mysterious disease. Of all the diseases in our work, commonly encountered in my office in the hospital, there are 117, but this is the most destructive in my experience, believe me. And that's the experience of a psychiatrist. I will tell you in the traditional fashion of my approach to AA, how I got involved in it, and I will do it in this way. I took step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself at that time could restore me to sanity. I just came to an awareness. There was a power greater than myself. At the age of 6, mind you. Now, don't get me wrong, I wasn't drinking, not even paregoric. But I had this experience at the age of 6 in my grandmother's little garden in the little backyard in Detroit, west side of Detroit. I saw her plant seeds, I thought, rather carelessly, throwing them into the fertile black soil. And as the spring came along, and the warmth of the sun, and the light of the sun increased, I saw this black soil give out with little stems, little green stems that penetrated to the soil. I saw little stems that grew taller and taller and taller, and then they branched out into smaller stems, into little leaves and buds and flowers. And at the age of 6, I had an experience of step 2. Because there in that garden at the age of 6, I came across the perfect design, the perfect beauty, the perfect harmony, the perfect order, the perfect biological obedience. This perfection did not come about by itself. I said my grandmother threw these in very carelessly. And she, it was not her doing. This didn't come about by anything my mother did or my father did. I live with my grandmother or my grandmother. This came about by a power greater than my grandmother and greater than my parents, greater than myself. And it was wonderful to have that step two at the age of 6. And I live with my grandmother, who was a strict woman. And she did to me what AAs did to me when I walked in the group. She had me pray. First thing they told me in AA was, get on your knees in the morning. And that's what my grandmother did when I was 6 years of age. Get on your knees. And I took step 3 when I was 6 years of age, 6, 7. Step 3, I submitted my life and will to God every morning. And I thank God for the wonder and with gratitude for the experiences I had that day in the evening. What a wonderful experience that was, the serenity that was mine, the experience of submitting myself in my will to the care of God at the age of 6. And I had this non-neurotic childhood. This non-neurotic. I didn't have to take pills. I didn't have to take phenobarb or Gelucil or any tranquilizers, soda tablets for heartburns. I didn't take anything. I had this serenity with step 2 and step 3 when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. I went to college. Then all hell broke loose. And there was no transition. I just love to hear these speakers say, well, I was a social drinker. I was a healthy drinker until I joined the army, I got married, and all this sort of thing. My drinking was sick drinking from the very beginning. I have to start my alcoholism right here at the beginning of the drink. There was no healthy, social, normal drinking. I liked it from the start. I like how it tasted, I like what it did to me, and I like all of it, and more of it if I get it. Well, let's remember, my drinking was not the kind of drinking that you may have forgotten about. This is the drinking of the Roaring 20 days, or the Untouchable days, you know, some pretty rot-gut stuff. College student, the allowance stuff we couldn't afford to by the Canadian stuff that wasn't far from me. It was not bad. Even that was cut with wood alcohol and blinded many. But there was no transition here. I just started to drink it, and I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. And I know that I was an alcoholic. As I ponder the past and the things that happened to me at alumni meetings. At alumni meetings of Wayne State University, I meet people who haven't seen me for some time and say, "Hi, boy, hi, Church. I haven't seen you in a long time. My gosh, Al, you've changed. You've gotten fatter and all that sort of thing. I remember you when..." And I think they're going to say, "I remember you when you were editor of the college paper, winner of the oratorical contest. When you were this, you were that." And I had quite a career in college. They don't say that. They say, "I remember you," and they pause when you puked. And when you went to Phi Chi fraternity house on their new furniture yet. "I remember you when the police picked you up on 3rd and Warren in February with only your shorts." This is a recall. This is not healthy drinking. No question about it. Well, they take my inventory, which I don't want to cite here because my wife is in the audience. But they take my inventory. And I know that there was no... So I was an alcoholic, and I had this hypersensitivity to alcohol from the very beginning. But together with education and alcoholism are a good combination, believe me. Education inflates your ego. You know, education didn't develop me. It swelled me. Now, you add that swelling to the swelling of the bloating of alcohol, you got a heck of a good combination. You become a bloated, swollen egomaniac. I just love knowledge. I love to know a lot of things. And in my scientific courses, I learned many things. I learned, for example, how this earth was formed and how man came about. That was great. That's great information for an alcoholic to have, because a lot of people don't have that information. But I learned that a glob of 4 billion years ago, or 2.5, I don't think at this retreat we care for 2 billion years. What's 2 billion years in our lives today? But I learned that a glob of gas came off the hot flaming gas came off the sun and spun around and orbit around the sun. And as it left the sun, it cooled off, formed a sphere, and became this earth, this little earth, one of the planets. And then as it left the sun further after a few more million years, it cooled off to a point where all the moisture on it condensed and formed the 200 million cubic miles of water from the oceans. And in the ocean, there was some plant life that eventually became animal life, the simple animal life of the amoeba and the paramecium, and then later became complicated fish life, and then the fish life evolved to become, to get out of the ocean, to become terrestrial animals. Terrestrial animals start climbing trees, became arboreal animals, the chimpanzee and the ape and all that. Then man came along. This is no minor boast, you know, from amoeba to man, or from the ape to man, is no minor boast. This is all scientific information for an alcoholic to have. My grandmother didn't know that, stupid little woman. My mother didn't know that. There's a lot of information for an alcoholic. Alcohol and this information just gave me what I needed, this ego that we have, and just made it a real alcoholic ego. And I was very proud of that, of all the knowledge, my scientific courses. And I interpreted that because alcohol impairs your judgment and impairs your finer ethical sensibilities, your finer reasonings. And with the help of this education, I interpreted all of this fascination of 4 billion years and a man being 1,700,000 years and having lived for 4 glacier periods and all that. I interpreted that all come about by accident, by science, by physical, chemical, biological laws. I left God out of it, Charlie. I became an atheist. And I wrote articles on atheism. They're so convincing, I'm afraid to read them now. I was the 1928 beatnik. Without the beard. Just a little mustache. Then education took another turn for me. I went into medicine. There I entered, upon entering medicine, medical school, I was given a cadaver. It's a body given for purposes of dissection. It's a preserved body. I must say, a preserved dead body. Because some naive people think they're a preserved live body. They've seen preserved bodies so often, they think it's a preserved live body. But I'm talking about a preserved dead body. And the first assignment of 9 weeks was a dissection. Careful dissection, taking apart all the structures from the fingertips to the elbow. John Mooney said he did his in 3 weeks. It took me 9. Of course, John Mooney is brilliant. But it took me 9 weeks to work out the structures. All the tendons and all the arteries, all the veins and lymph vessels and the tendons and the attachments and the 8 muscles of the wrist and the 35 muscles and tendons of the forearm. And I dissected them very carefully. And the professor came after 9 weeks and he asked me, "What's this?" We told him in Latin, you see. "This is what this is, where it's attached, is what it does." He said, "You have a perfect recitation. Doctor," he says, "you know, in medical school they call you a doctor right after your first tuition." "The doctor, you have a perfect recitation." Well, I was very proud of that, believe me. But there was some other feeling that I had. It resembled a feeling that I had when I was a boy, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. When I had that feeling in my grandmother's garden, when I came across my first experience with the perfect order, the perfect design, the perfect rhythm, the perfect biological obedience, the perfect harmony I saw in the structures of this hand and the forearm. And I felt so comfortable to have that experience again. Then I turned to my partner, I said, "There's a God." When I finished getting my A, "There's a God." He thought I went off the rocker. And then that evening I had an experience that supplemented the morning experience of the anatomy. My wife now and my girlfriend then took me to hear Heifetz. And I heard this wonderful concert. And he played the concerto in E minor, Mendelssohn's concerto in E minor, opus 64. And as he was playing it, I watched his fingers on the keyboard. I watched the tendons. You know, don't forget, I just completed, I got an A. And I named all the muscles that he was using. I would say that's the extensor pollicis longus, and that's the abductions pollicis. Digitorum communis, and she was already practicing to be away from an alcoholic. She said, "Shut up." She said, "Shut up and listen." And I'm glad I listened, because this made this experience of the perfect harmony and perfect beauty even more meaningful, because I could see that he was using his right upper extremity and with the bow and fingering property with the left hand on the fingerboard with different pressures, different positions to produce this beautiful music. And I said to her, "There's a God." Well, she thought I went out the rocker too. But it brought me back to that wonderful realization that I had at the age of 6 in my grandmother's garden when I looked at her garden, flower garden. And I thought of all the things that went on in Heifetz's mind, you know, the use of his vision to visualize the notes and the hearing and all that. My gosh, it's great. It's just great. And I came back to step 2. And I went to a little priest and I told him that I found God in the cadaver looking for step 3. And he thought I killed somebody. When I told him I was a medical student, he was greatly relieved. And I started at step 3 and believed and submitted my life, went back to prayer. And submitted my life and will to the care of God, believe me, because medical school is rough and tough, especially if you work nights. But this is a progressive, powerful disease. And while I work nights, you'd think if I worked 6 nights a week and if I had 1 night off, I would study or go to sleep and rest. No, I drank. I drank that night. And my wife is here to attest to this fact. That I drank that night to make up for the other 6 nights. I think 20 whiskey sours is a lot for 1 night for a medical student. And to get so sick But I was a medical student, and I know how I relieved myself. At 2 o'clock, and we closed at 2 o'clock, and we went somewhere after 2 o'clock, please. By 3 o'clock, I was near her home because I couldn't go back to the clinic where I worked night. And I would have to go to the nearest alley, but I knew how to do it. I used a two-finger method myself. Fellas that use one-finger method and don't do a good job. But the two-finger method was very adequate. And so I would lie down on the floor in the apartment, her mother and father not knowing that I was there sometime, not knowing the condition I came in, they were asleep. But that was my one night off a week, and that was the alcoholic pattern there. But many things came back to me with this coming back to prayer, because I came back to pray and meditate and ask God to help me through medical school, but I continued to drink. But many things came to me that were so different after this experience of coming back to step two. All of this knowledge that I had about the planet and how this earth was formed, and I realized that there are 300 trillion planets. 300 trillion planets in this galaxy of ours, this galaxy being a saucer-shaped grouping of planets. 300 trillion in this one galaxy, this one grouping, of which Earth is one. And when I learned that it was the diameter of that was 20 and 22 zeros miles wide, 20 and 22 zeros miles wide, I was able, believe me, after that realization, to pray humbly. And my step 3 and step 11 were taken when I was in medical school. I was involved with alcohol, believe me, but I was taking these steps already. There I saw this perfection again. The awareness became emphasized, and I became humble. The same experience I had when I came to AA, they asked me, one of the fellows asked me, how do I pray? First I told him, mind your own business. Because I was annoyed, as I will tell you later, with AA, some of the members in AA, and how they approached me. They were actually helping me and sponsoring me, but I was annoyed with them. How do you pray? Are you a sitter prayer or a squatter prayer? Why don't you become a kneeler prayer? Kneel down. And I thought, well, that's what my grandmother said. And I knelt and I bowed. Believe me, the more AA I have, the lower I bow, because I know this God and these 300 trillion planets in one galaxy. And when I learned later that there were 100 trillion such galaxies, then why shouldn't I kneel? Why should I be a squatter or a sitter prayer? But the disease is progressive. I went along. After I graduated, I left Detroit and went to Washington. And I had to account for my drinking. That one night was a good excuse. I don't drink six nights. I had a good time. I had to relax that one night. That's a very good reason for doing a bad thing. It was a logical reason. Everybody thought, well, certainly let him get drunk that night. Everybody agreed with me. But in Washington, I didn't have that excuse. I had to find some other excuses. So I found occasions to explain my drinking. I drank on my birthday. That's very justifiable and logical. I drank for my wife's birthday. That's all right, too. Our anniversary, certainly I'd get potted. I celebrated George Washington's birthday, Lincoln's birthday, and 4th July, Memorial Day, my brother-in-law's anniversary. Look around for occasions. And the heat of Washington was a very good excuse for drinking. It was hot. You had to keep cool. So we made daiquiris. And I went to the Bar Mart on Connecticut, and I got a pitcher this high. I poured all the rum into it and then put the ice and all the mix. And my wife would say, well, why? What are you doing this for? I'd say, well, the stewards are coming over. She said, well, you know they don't drink. I said, they might ask for a drink. But I would drink it myself. I would celebrate other people's occasions. One of my wife's friends came over with his wife for an anniversary, and that was very nice to celebrate their anniversary. But here's what I heard. This fellow said, gee, your husband's a great guy, celebrating my anniversary. He's a great guy, celebrating my anniversary. But you know, when you run out of occasions, you're in trouble. I had to celebrate the invention of Eli Whitney's patent, Jim. Fulton's invention of the steamship. Then you're getting into trouble. And you have to get the Farmer's Almanac or something like that to help you. And I went to New York, and I didn't have to find... I used the occasions right along. That's always a good reason for drinking. You find what you want and go ahead and drink on that occasion. But I drank in many places in New York, and there are so many places in New York, so you don't have to get drunk in the same place in the same year. Twice, you're a damn fool if you do, because they'll find out you're a drinker. So you go to different places each day or each week, what have you. I continued to drink. Finally, a little lady who knew I wasn't very well, at least, you know, when you drink like that, you have excuses of all kinds. You have a sickness of some kind. Some people have asthma and colitis, and they have sinus trouble. That's a good one. They're sick. Well, why don't you feel well? Well, my sinus is bothering me today. And they have a stomach upset. These are wonderful excuses. I had high blood pressure and pains in my chest. Excuse, that's a frightening one. These people suggested that I go to Boston to Leahy's Clinic. This lady says she's the number one lady in the country. Very elegant, prominent, and well-to-do lady. And she suggested that I go to Leahy's Clinic. She knew a Dr. Brown there, an expert in hypertension. So I went to Leahy's. And she arranged for me, or somebody arranged for me, to stay at this very fine apartment. It had 12 rooms and 4 baths and 2 bars. And I went to Leahy's to see Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown said, because Mrs. H. sent you to me, I will take my own history. I will not have an ordinary intern or resident take the history. I will take your history. So he went through a complete history. And he asked me my habits and all that, and he asked me if I drank, and I told him on occasions only. And I wasn't lying. But I lied to him like every alcoholic lies to me. And that's why they can never be diagnosed properly. I remember poor Dr. Brown, that's his real name, and he's this great expert in hypertension. He would take my blood pressure one day, he said, it's low today. How did he know what I drank that night before? And it's high today, it's low today. He finally asked me if I were ever in Africa, in the tropics. How could he make a diagnosis without knowing the full history? I don't think that eye doctors can examine or refract your eyes accurately if you're drinking. Now you wonder, my eyes hurt, my this and that, and this poor eye doctor looking in there with the eyes with another lens. Can you see worse with this one or better with this one? And he can get an accurate eye count or eye refraction. But this poor doctor worked with me. Finally, he gave up and said, you better go into the hospital. So he put me in the New England Deaconess Hospital for a week. And there I had this great experience of meeting this homicide detective. This homicide detective. And he was dying from cancer. But as I told you, I'm not too stupid. And I recognized that he was having delirium tremens at that point. He had all the signs of it. He had the sweat and the apprehensive look and the tremors. And he was looking around, seeing things. And I said, would you want a drink? He said, would you? That gave me an idea. So I dressed, I waited till the doctors made the rounds. Now get my street clothes, get a taxi, go to the nearest packet store and get 2 half pints, one for the detective, one for me. The real problem came in disposing of the bottles. This is the morning after. You can't put those empties into the wastebasket. You know what the hospital wastebasket is like, they're very empty. And we certainly weren't going to have our characters maligned by carelessness. So I said, you're a big detective. What do you do with those bottles? You're a big psychiatrist. You get rid of the bottle. No, you're a big detective. You get rid of the bottle. So I said, well, you do it. He said, well, all right, use the direct police method. So here's what he told me to do, the direct police method. Put the bottles inside the room, just inside the door. Call the nurse and tell her, get these out of here. And it worked. She was very embarrassed about the whole thing. But came the second day, I went out, got the two bottles, second day. And he said, now's your chance, Freud. So I had to devise methods. Well, I used my friends who came to visit. I told them to dispose of these. The little nurse had a party. I didn't want to embarrass her. She'd be getting in trouble. Please take these empties and put them in a rubbish can outside the hospital. Sure, Doc, anything. And then we watched the trays of food that go by. This was during the war. There were many 4Fs at that time in these hospitals. We were past 90. And you could put the bottles on the trays right with the food. And the best bet was the laundry, the pull of the canvas bags of laundry. They're very noiseless. You just drop the bottles as they go by. So here's a real alcoholic problem, you see. While I'm drunk in this hospital, getting diagnosed incorrectly, a telephone call came from Detroit asking me to come to Detroit to work in this hospital, to become a medical director of a large mental hospital, a 300-bed mental hospital. I didn't know it was full of alcoholics, but they were serving alcoholics. We were admitting many alcoholics in the hospital. I didn't know that. Because all of my training had been with child work, with juvenile delinquency. 2 years in Washington, 5 years in New York. But I accepted this job. Maybe the best thing that ever happened, maybe somebody was praying for me that I did accept it, because there I came across this great experience of 9,000 alcoholics. There I learned two things, that I was an alcoholic. I learned that, and that's a great thing after 5,800 came my way, as I told you. But I accepted that job and learned that I was one myself. But believe me, when I learned it, maybe it's not the way you learned it. You had reservations about it. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. I'll give another try. No, I knew for sure I was one. And my wife and I got in this duet. You are alcoholic, Dad. You have that disease. Yes, Mother, I am alcoholic. I know that. It was a duet we sang for years after. Very familiar sounding words. Well, the drinking continued and led to some embarrassing situations, some rather dangerous situations in my life, and could have disturbed my whole life, my family's life. But they got worse and worse and worse, because this is a progressive disease. And I remember one experience in December of 56 where I was to put on a show for the families of the Detroit Players. I'm an amateur magician, so they dressed me up as a clown. And I had this red nose and the black ear and the little this wig on me, you know, the little cap they had on the clowns wear. And I worked on a morning show with a bottle of cognac in the black bag. And if each time I produced the trick, I would go to the black bag and swig. And I would swig this bottle, and I was very drunk before the show was over. But the afternoon show was for the families of the players. Well, I wasn't there in that show. My family, my wife brought some children other than mine, and they waited for the great magician, the father. I was not there. I was in my office. They gave me a Mickey or something, and had a cab driver put me on my couch in my office. When I awakened at 7 o'clock, I didn't know where I was. I looked around, very strange. The whole thing was strange. Where's the show? I went to the mirror to see how I looked, and I saw a clown. And I thought, my God, I'm really off the rocker. There's a clown there. This is a vision. This is a hallucination. I was a clown. Just as I was about to become excited about his hallucination, this little lady came to me and said, gee, doctor, you certainly were drunk. I couldn't awaken you for an hour. Was I glad to see her. I looked around, it was me, you see. It was the clown, too, was myself. But to see that image of the clown, the red nose, and the mirror is something frightening when you wake up. But I was very embarrassed about the whole thing, lying on my couch in a clown suit, drunk, my family embarrassed, and my family terribly shocked by the experience. So to make up for this experience, I took my family to a dude ranch to dry out, to talk things over with them and my wife, to go out to the desert. How wonderfully symbolic going to a desert is to meditate and talk things over, you see. And I would dry out on that desert. So we chose a ranch, a 49er, and we checked in there for Christmas. And
I was 2 days dry. But the third day, I feigned illness, the usual thing. I don't feel so good. I don't think I want to go to the cow wagon, chuck wagon they call it, or something like that. And I could hear the horses in the distance. And I thought, this is my chance to go to the recreation room where the liquor was held by the various dudes in little lockers. You know, those dudes are the most trusting people. Every single locker was locked. There wasn't one open one. Now, how do you open up these little locks? I'm 17 miles away from Tucson. How do I get into these little cubby holes in which you kept the liquor? So I thought of bobby pins. Having worked with delinquents for 5 years, they had in New York, the dead-end kids, I knew how to open up locks. But I said, get bobby pins. So I went to my wife's luggage, my daughter's luggage, and they had no bobby pins. Not a bobby pin. And that was the beginning of my resentment with my wife. She said, no bobby pins. I couldn't understand. I said, why my wife wouldn't have bobby pins? So what's the next step? The next step is to go to other people's cabin for bobby pins. So I went to other people's cabins and got bobby pins, various size and shape, and fired these locks. They're herd locks. I recommend them highly. None of them open. None of them open. I looked in the mirror, and while I did not really need a haircut, I said, you need a haircut. Now, alcohol is talking. This isn't Al Church talking. It's alcohol talking. You need a haircut. I didn't need a haircut. I just had one a week before then. But you need a haircut. You look awful. So I took the car and went to Barber, 17 miles away at Tucson, you see, to get a haircut. And while I'm getting that haircut, this fellow is a retired barber. Everybody's retired in Tucson. This fellow must have been retired 40 years. He was talking about Detroit when Marquette arrived there from France or something. And he gave me this haircut by hand because I was a Detroiter and this is a special haircut. So he worked on me for a full hour, trimming it very carefully. That what he didn't know was that I was looking in the mirror. He had me facing the mirror, and all the time there's a sign which is suspended from the store next door. This sign said liquor. And for a whole hour, I watched the reflection of that sign. Liquor, 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 for a whole hour. Now, here's the way I left that barber shop. I threw $5 at him. I said, thanks, Dad, fine haircut. So here's the way I walked out of that barber shop. I walked in next door to the liquor store, and I asked this gal, when she asked me what I wanted, 48 half pints of cognac. You see, alcohol was thinking. That answer wasn't devised by me. I didn't have to intellectualize that answer. Think it out. That was what I wanted. Half pints. She said, you'll get them in larger sizes. I said, well, I'm sure of that, but I want to use them as place cards for a party I'm having. I want to attach the names of our guests. She said, well, the 49er doesn't have that many guests. You have only 17 guests. I said, I'm inviting people for the ranches, you fool. But alcohol was doing all that talking. I could never have thought of that. If I were writing a book, I couldn't think of it. But this is alcohol talking. Now, you know, alcohol was more reasonable than I. I would have had a big jug wholesale, but no. I knew that I couldn't hide a gallon in this much manure. I knew the cactus plants, the wall was this thick. I need a very sharp knife and a sonic chisel to hide it in the cactus plant, you see. There's alcohol doing all this, you see. Wonderful thing. This is my experience with meditation and getting out in the desert, talk it over. Alcohol was winning again. Booze was doing the thinking for me. But all the time that I was in, when I returned, all the time that I pondered this issue, I am alcoholic. Yes, you are alcoholic, Dad. Yes, I'm alcoholic, Mother. There's no question about it. I know without reservation that I am. For 5 years after I said that, I had another blind spot. The first blind spot was to not recognize the illness in myself until 5,800 alcoholics came my way. First-hand experience, personal experience, at the bedside, listening to the histories, listening to them, I had a blind spot to this diagnosis. The second blind spot was that I did not want to accept AA. I was told about it, I read about it, but I would not get into it. The blind spot was AA was not for you. There was pride, there was fear, I was afraid to be without liquor, that's it. Afraid it would be without alcohol, that's why I didn't want AA. And there was a dependency. I was afraid what my people might think. Because alcoholics are fearful people and proud people and dependent people. I was afraid what somebody might say. And there's an immaturity
characteristic, if there ever was, to be afraid of what people might say. Now, that you belong to AA. I was afraid to get an AA. I tried everything. I tried antabuse for 8 months. I went to a doctor and he told me that he was pleased that I was sober and he heard about it, but he told me he didn't know I was taking antabuse. I told him I was using willpower. And he said, you have hypertension, but I don't want to give you these fancy drugs such as Rowulfia serpentina and the reserpines and this acerpacil and all that. I want you to go back to drinking. Have a drink or two or three or four per day, but have your wife ration them out. And so to make a long story short, even my wife was affected by this illness at that point. Because she knew I was alcoholic, I know I was alcoholic. Driving from the doctor, she said to me, maybe the antabuse broke the pattern. That was a stupid idea, wasn't it? Maybe the antabuse, after all of that experience, maybe the antabuse had broken the pattern. So I went back to social drinking. And it worked for a while, but it went back into sick drinking. I would call her from the office, eventually as it went down, and tell her, she kept track of my time, and when I left the house, I left the office, and I'd say, I'm leaving the office in 15 minutes. Actually, I'd leave the office that very minute. I'd say, I'm leaving the office in 15 minutes. That gave me 15 minutes to drink, and I couldn't go too far. I had only 15 minutes. I could not waste time on transportation. I had a drink in the bar below, which is a rather crummy bar. I'd say, I'm leaving the office in 15 minutes. I leave at that point. And I met the bartender sometime after I dried out, and he said, I want to ask you a question, Doc. What was the idea of having 10 doubles in 15 minutes? I told him, well, that's all the time I had. The poor guy is still scratching his head. He doesn't know what I meant by that. I tried psychiatry, too. I didn't hear about your doctor, Gertrude, this wonderful doctor. I would have gone to him. I had a little better doctor in Chicago. Gertrude had tough luck with this psychiatrist. I had a little better luck. He didn't get me well, but he told me I could stand psychoanalysis. And to our good friend Franz Alexander in Chicago, and he told me I could stand psychoanalysis. I didn't give him the full story of my drinking, as I told you. I lied to him as all alcoholics lie to me. I had to give up treatment of alcoholics myself. Because I was tired of their lies, I was tired of the odor in my office, I was tired of the snoring, appointments being broken, and I thought I'd be do something more useful, because all the time, back in my mind, I knew that AA was the answer. All the time, I knew, for 5 years, I knew AA was the answer. I saw people come out of sick beds. I saw people come out of sick beds and so destroyed physically and psychologically and socially that I put them down as hopeless alcoholics. I saw them months later and they were coming to 12-step other patients. I had that experience over and over again, so I knew the work of AA. I used to sit on a bed, on the bedside with the AA, trying to get AA sneaky without joining it. Reading the book, listening to steps, and but having all information, I was not able to take AA. Finally, the situation came up which led me to AA. I decided I had a rough night, February 4th, 57. Very rough night, February 5th. I heard my Al-Anon wife talked to my daughter outside of the room, and they both said very kind, warm words. Dad ought to do something about his drinking. He ought to know what to do. He should know. He's a psychiatrist. He ought to help himself. And he should follow the directions. She knew I was getting people in AA. And doing a darn good job 12-stepping, but I couldn't 12-step myself. When I heard these kind words, I called her in. This is a rough, right? The roughest of the rough. And I called her. I said, well, I made up my mind. I finally grew up, as I put it. I finally grew up. I became independent. I was dependent. I was always afraid of what people might say about my belonging to AA. All of a sudden, I became a mature psychiatrist. And that's something. I called my wife in the room and I said, I'm going to join AA. I don't care what anybody thinks. See, what anybody thinks. I don't care what the people at the hospital think. My confreres, the neighbors, my relatives. I don't care. I'm going to join AA. I'm going to find myself a group. She said, you needn't bother. I've been going to Al-Anon meetings for 4 months. And I've got the group picked out for you. She said, you won't know a soul in that group that I picked out for you. And that was a big lie. Because when I went there, everybody knew me. I walked down those steps and went in a room, and my gosh, they all, how are you, Doc? What are you doing? Observing? Studying AA? I said, no, I'm an alcoholic. And I heard strange things about that. Good for you. I thought they're crazy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not here. I'm here for help. I'm an alcoholic. Well, good for you. Wonderful. They became elated about me joining the outfit. I thought the whole bunch was nuts. For me to say that I was alcoholic and they were so delighted. Actually, what they meant, you know what they meant. They meant they were glad I joined AA, came and joined them in the basement of that church. I didn't like that group too much. I didn't see enough Cadillacs in front of the church. Mine was the only Cadillac. Alcoholics must drive Cadillacs, drunk or sober. I didn't like the guys that didn't wear belts and had no teeth and chewed tobacco besides. I liked the guy who held his belt and put his teeth in there. Hi, Doc. I didn't like fourth graders talking to me. There's one fellow, I'm running the church, and this fellow shouts out when there are other people going into the various affairs in that church, and he shouts at me, where are you running to, Doc? I said, I'm running to the meeting. I'm late. You've been chasing booze all your life. Walk to an AA meeting, Doc. Well, there's a wonderful, sensible guy. The same guy who, after 5 months, said, how long you been in, Doc? I said, 5 months. He said, well, you're still very tense. I said, you mind your own damn tensions. I'm the psychiatrist. I'll tell you when I'm tense. And I'll tell you when you're tense. I didn't like that. When he's the guy who asked me if I'm a squatter, a sitter, prayer, or kneeler prayer, he's the guy that I got to love very much. But many things came to me in this whole business of AA. And I would take the few minutes to tell you about them. I learned that I was a neurotic. And I handle neurotics all the time. I learned that so many things about this neurosis. You know the difference between a neurosis and a psychosis? The insane people and nervous people. The insane people think that 2 and 2 is 5. The insane people think 2 and 2 is 5. And are happy with it. And the nervous people know that 2 and 2 is 4 and unhappy about it. I don't know why I threw that in. I learned the neurotics were resentful people and proud people. And that AA had the chief ingredients for the cure of the neurosis. The basic cure. Because the resentful, this is all free of charge, John. I don't charge for this advice. The neurotic is a proud and resentful person. And AA, 12 steps, have the answer. Because the antidote for pride is humility. And certainly when you take the first step and the second step and a third, you're getting over your pride. And you're getting humble. You got your first treatment right there. And what is the answer for your resentment? You've got gratitude. I don't know of any more grateful people. The successful, serene AAs are grateful people. I've seen more gratitude here than I have in any meeting I've ever been at. And I see normal, non-neurotic people. And I'm very much interested in this because as a psychiatrist, I come across people who have all kinds of ailments, and they have ailments of all kinds. There's an ulcer, the end product of a neurosis. Ulcers, hypertension, colitis, gallbladder. And I'm interested because I know, as a psychiatrist with 27 years of experience, that the ulcer is the end product of anxiety, the end product of pride and resentments. Hypertension is that. Colitis is that. We don't feel with just our minds, we feel with our organs. Whenever we resent, you don't resent with only your mind, you resent with your spleen. You hate with your bowel. You're angry with your heart. You're fearful with your gallbladder. If a mad dog were to walk in here, you would, and frothing at the mouth, and you would, and a dog, and his tail behind his, in between his hind legs, you'd have an emotional experience. You'd be afraid. You'd be afraid, and you'd know that you are afraid, not by the dog coming at you. You'd know by sensations you have bodily. Your heart would beat fast against the chest wall, and you'd have all these changes in your bodily organs. And if John Mooney would remove the dog, you'd all relax. The pulse would settle down, your heart rate would stop, your gallbladder would relax, your liver would relax, your bladder would relax, not too much, I hope. But you wouldn't have, you're not a neurotic. You would have only one experience. But if the mad dog came in here for 3 days every hour, you'd develop a neurosis, you'd have rapid pulse, you'd even have a gallstone. Gallstone would form because you'd clamp down on that opening from the gallstone and the fluid would run. Now you'd form stones. You'd go to a doctor with stones. He says, you've been eating too much fat. I think you've been resentful. Or you've been fearful. What I'm trying to say, emotions affect the organs depending on how you're built, you see. But here is a remedy for the neurosis. Here's a remedy for your physical health. Gratitude. And you get this program a good... Working out, you've got gratitude and you've got humility, the two chief ingredients for the treatment of a neurosis. A neurotic is also a person who lives with the regrets of yesterday and anticipations of all kinds of calamity tomorrow. You talk to neurotics, they regret this happening, they shouldn't have married her, they shouldn't have had the kids, they shouldn't have bought the house, they shouldn't have had that mother, and the mother shouldn't have breastfed them, should have bottle fed them. And this goes on and on, regret after regret. And they live like that. And they come in the car to tell you know, my mother switched me from the right breast to the left breast. That's why I'm neurotic. Can't make up my mind. Every time I got into a bar, the psychiatrist asked, what do you want? I couldn't make up my mind. I wanted everything. And I was like, maybe my mother switched me too much, you know? But they live with the regrets of yesterday, anticipation of tomorrow. Tomorrow may happen. Something may happen tomorrow. That's why I lived when I was drinking all the time. There's living yesterdays and tomorrows. This lady who came to my office a couple weeks ago, she said to me, I'm so worried and worried. I said, what about it? Well, my daughter will marry the wrong man. We had this wonderful home. We lost our business. And I'm in a poor neighborhood. And she might marry some poor quality husband. Well, how old is your daughter? She said, 10. And here's the answer in AA. See, live a day at a time. Normal people live it a day at a time. They don't live in yesterdays or tomorrows. They leave tomorrow to God, and they know tomorrow. Yesterdays do not count. Yesterdays do not count in our lives, do they? Not a bit. If they do, we're going to get drunk. And we know that day at a time. Here is the great contribution. Here are the things that have been meaningful to me as a psychiatrist. Why shouldn't I be grateful? AA has taught me to live, be satisfied with today, to accept today. People in this country live with expectations of unreal things. I sent a questionnaire out to several hundred high school seniors and asked them what they expect from life, and my God, it's all fantasy. The girls who choose careers are going to be successful, and yet less than 0.5% will be successful. And the girls who are going to marry are going to marry handsome men, fully, constantly employed. Vacations paid for, the car will be paid for, the house will be paid for. And you know damn well she'll marry a bald-headed guy with dentures. And the house will never be paid for. And there's trouble, the reality is there. I was telling a nurse's class this very story because there were young nurses. And she said, "Doctor, you're a pessimist." I said, "No, I'm a realist, and I want to be a realist. Because realists don't come to my office as patients. It's the unrealists." AA says, accept, in the great serenity prayer. Give us a serenity. Accept the things that we can't change. Life is full of misery. Life, I'll give you a definition of life, and if you get depressed or anxious with this definition, I'll give you a shock treatment free of charge. Here's the definition of life. Life is a series of thwarting, unpleasant, painful experiences. And that's all it is. And we know it, but we live it and accept it. And if we can't, we ask God to help us accept this life. But this all comes out of AA. Gave me this great comfort that I have. Gave me this great comfort and gave me this feeling that I have when I work with patients, believe me. And I wish I could give that feeling to you. But I don't want you to think that you have to. This feeling of humility came to me with knowing as much as I do and much as I have studied about the 300 trillion stars and planets. I don't want you to have the feeling that you have to have the knowledge of this one galaxy being 22 miles wide. No, because I know that you can find God in simpler things. You don't have to be shepherd. You don't have to be an astronaut whirling around in space to become aware, to have that kind of an awareness that there's a power greater than yourself. You can find that awareness in simple things. And my wife gave me this, and I'll read it to you. God manifests himself in simple things. The morning star that ushers in the day. An opening rose, a bird on whispering wings. A wind-touched leaf that dances a belay. God manifests himself in children's eyes that open gratefully to glimpse the sun, that widen with a look of wide surprise at any hint of unexpected fun. God manifests himself in fields of grain, in fragrant fruit that draws the honeybees, in drops of dew, a spider's silken skein, in little waves along the shores of seas. You need not seek for God on soaring wings. He manifests himself in simple things. I am grateful for AA. Closing, I'll make the statement as I did before. I'm very grateful from the tips of my hair to my toes because I came to AA blind. And AA has enlightened my blindness. I came in the AA wounded, believe me. And AA has bound and dressed my wounds. AA has relieved my guilt. I had a lot of that, and I'm still working on that. AA has led me to the fold that from which I was led astray. AA gave me that non-neurotic feeling, that same feeling I had when I was 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, and I'm trying to restore it in my grandmother's garden and at the bedside when she had me pray and take the second and third step so serenely, putting my hand in God's hand and walking with him all day. No tranquilizers, no booze, no nothing, not afraid to look at people and being giving honest answers. I went out tomorrow, when I go to church tomorrow, I'm going to pray for all of us, pray for you wonderful people, that we hunger more for AA. I should say thirst, you'll understand that better. That you thirst more for AA. That AA has become the flood tide of my pleasure. It's become my hope, become my trust. When I was drinking, I didn't trust my own mother, and certainly my wife. I was a restless, wild guy, and AA gave me rest. AA gave me quiet, the quiet we're experiencing here. AA gave me refuge. AA gave me the health. AA gave me wealth. AA has replaced the tensions that were within me with a holy relaxation. AA has replaced the turbulence within me with a sacred calm. AA has replaced the anxiety within me with a quiet confidence. The fear I had within me with a strong faith. The bitterness within me was a sweetness of grace. The darkness within me with a gentle light, and the coldness within me with a loving warmth. AA is straightening out my crookedness. It's filled my emptiness. I came in here empty. I feel better. AA has dulled the edge of my pride, sharpened the edge of my humility. AA has lit the fires of my love and quenched the flames of my lust. I want to say one thing. I love all of you. And I'll pray for you tomorrow.